Hello, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here once again on PRN-FM. Before we begin our media channel program, I just want to acknowledge the passing today of the fabulous actress Ruby Dee, who I knew personally and who made such a great contribution, not only to the theater, not only to the black theater, but to the civil rights cause in America. Ruby Dee died today at age 91, I believe, and will be missed.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
27 stations carry no news of the world.
So where's the news of the people left out? Put a camera in my face just to hear me shout. But they don't want to hear what I shout about. You're loving women with cuffs, but not a people rip up. We never play the lead in the sitcom you call the news. Unless we're accused, positive refuse. The poor and unschooled most need dope. But it's the inside joke that holds the hope. Can't cope with the selling of news like toothpaste. Spitting out headlines in mad haste.
Countless celebrity guests.
We gotta stop the flow of news goo. Keeping us drunk on the
We've gotta stop the flow of news goo. That was the lyrics of Polarity One's song News Goo, which he wrote as part of an effort to promote the media and democracy congresses in the late 80s, fighting for media freedom in America. This week on MediaChannel.org radio here on PRN, we're going to be talking more about the media. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. Welcome to the program and to our guest this week, Andrew Tindall, one of the leading analysts, researchers of news on television in America. Tindall publishes the Tindall Report. It monitors the weekday nightly newscasts of the three American broadcast television networks, ABC World News with Diane Sawyer, formerly Charles Gibson, CBS Evening News with Scott Pelley, formerly Kate Couric, and NBC Nightly News with Brian Williams, formerly in the past, anyway, Tom Brokaw. Each day, Tindall blogs the three newscasts. He's been monitoring TV news for 20 years. He claims to be, and we'll ask him about this, the only person on the planet who has personally watched every single weekday network nightly newscast since the summer of 1987. Other people go on vacation. He records them and logs the news into his database, which when he returns and then offers them as analysis of what actually is being reported on TV news in America. Welcome, Andrew Tindall.
Well, nice to talk to you, Danny. Long time no see.
Indeed. And also, your work goes on as it has for all these years. Why? Why? I know it's a business. I know that you, this is a way you make your living, but also it's a passion of yours. Tell us about how that started, to become this analyst of network news.
Yes. Well, you know, in this day and age, when we have the fragmentation of media and everybody gets their own news from whatever source they want, going online or from their social network or whatever, there's still such a thing as what people call the mainstream media, the MSM. And the pinnacle of the mainstream media, the outlet which has the most number of viewers, is still on television, and it's still the broadcast, the old broadcast networks, and their half-hour nightly newscasts. So if you want to know what the mainstream media's news agenda is, you've got no better place to go to find out what they're devoting their resources to, what they think is important, what they think the nation as a whole should be paying attention to. You've got no better place to go to than to look at what they're deciding to put on the news every night.
Now, just for starters, many people believe that all of this is the past, that somehow Fox News or MSNBC or CNN have the whole news audience on television. True, not true?
That's completely untrue. It always has been untrue, and it is untrue to this day. In fact, the cable news channels are losing audience at a faster rate than the network nightly newscasts. And just in terms of numbers, the number of people who watch one or other of the three nightly newscasts every night, that's watch it live, not later on, downloading it or video streaming it, but actually watching it on their television sets, is north of 20 million people every night. The three cable news channels that you talked about, they get less than 4 million people at the same time.
So this is a good example of perception and reality, or perception versus reality. Somehow, many people believe, perhaps because, you know, most of the satire that's done by people like Jon Stewart deals with the cable networks, that somehow that's where most people are getting their news. Not true. And in fact, the network newscasts are, if not as strong as ever, certainly still very strong and compelling to millions of people in this country.
The way to say it is, all news outlets have smaller audiences than they used to have because the entire media landscape is fragmenting because of the internet. But the ratio of the audience of the network nightly newscasts, in other words, how much greater their audience is to their next competitor, that margin is still the same, as big as it always has been. Because even if their audience is smaller than it used to be, so is everyone else's.
And maybe perhaps this is why the Edward Snowden interview on NBC, which was fully a year after he became public, when Brian Williams went to Russia to interview Edward Snowden, that became a sensation. It actually drove up their ratings, but it also showed the power of network news. True?
That's exactly true. And then this week, it's not quite as prestigious an interview because it wasn't as hard to get. Diane Sawyer did the interview with Hillary Clinton, and that made news all week as well.
So, you know, in a sense, if you are trying to change America, if you are working in any way, advocacy groups, alternative media, however, you really do have to know something about what Americans are seeing and hearing and learning in a way through the news programming in America. And many people, younger people, don't. They're see it all as old media, don't pay attention to it. But in many cases, that distances them from the very people they're trying to reach. True?
There's what you say is true. There are two ways of looking at this phenomenon. One, if you are in the business of trying to organize or agitate or change people's minds, then you've got to know how to deal with the mainstream media when in trying to shape your message, because that's how you get to the broad mass of people. But secondly, if you are trying to agitate or organize or change people's minds, you know you've made an impact when your way of looking at things finally gets covered by the mainstream media, because then it's a marker of that your way of looking at the world has entered the mainstream, because when they can cover it from your point of view, then you know you've been making progress.
Is news still a good business for the networks? Obviously, they're not doing this for charity or for public service, at least not the commercial networks, and probably not PBS either. They're doing it because of the revenues and they pay people who are on the air a lot of money, especially their anchors.
Right. So the news divisions of the broadcast networks, they have more than just the nightly newscasts that I watch, and where they make their most money is on the morning shows, on Today's Show and Good Morning America, those type of programs. They make them more money there because the cost of producing the program is a lot less, because you don't have to do so much on-the-ground reporting. It's much more guests who are coming into your studio, and you don't have to have so many personnel to do it. However, they can't exist by only putting on that two-hour program, that two-hour block early in the morning.
In other countries, it's called breakfast.
Breakfast, exactly. Morning television, breakfast television, wake-up television. It's a phenomenon that's worldwide. In almost all industrialized countries, this exists, because you're getting people up, you're telling them the weather, and you're getting them out the door to go to work. The thing is, those programs cannot stand alone. You have to have an actual news organization up and running, and that means that you've got to be able to cover news all the time, and therefore you have to be represented in all different parts of the day. The other thing about the American television the Organization of American Broadcast Television, is that these networks are actually networks with affiliates with local television news in each of the various cities of the country. And the local news...
Cities which they call markets, obviously.
Yes, right.
They have marketized everything.
If we're a citizen, we can call them cities, though, can't we?
Yes, we can.
Anyway, in each of these markets, the local television station, the place where they make most of their money is by producing their own local newscasts. And it's very advantageous for the local stations to have a network news presence which is associated with their local news. So both for reasons of getting audiences in the morning and also for reasons of keeping their affiliate stations happy in their network. The network news operation is a highly it's an essential part of the entire network operation.
Well, as you know, Andrew, I work for ABC and I work for CNN, and I've been writing about media and TV news for many years as well. And so, you know, but I've always found the work that you do extremely important, not only because it's accurate, but also because it's analytical in terms of offering us an understanding of what's being covered. Also, the audience, it's not only about numbers, aggregate numbers. It's about demographics, isn't it? Can you explain what that is about?
Right. The origins of broadcast television before the cable channels existed, the origins of broadcast cable was that they would make money not by charging for their programming, charging the viewers to watch their programming, but they'd make money by charging the advertisers to whom they would be delivering the eyeballs of the viewers. And obviously, in as far as advertisers are concerned, as far as Madison Avenue is concerned, not all viewers have the same value. So over time, the sophistication of the media buyers of the advertising agencies was such that they decided certain age groups or certain income groups were more valuable in terms of how much they would pay to advertise to them, and therefore the networks got themselves in a business of contorting their programming so they weren't addressing the entire population, but they were targeting it towards the most desirable demographic groups for the advertisers.
Because these demographic groups, particularly ones that are upwardly mobile or affluent, are more likely, more able, let's say even, to buy some of the products advertised. If you're advertising expensive vehicles, you know, on broadcasts where the viewers really have a low income or no income, you know, you're wasting time, in a sense, if your goal is to maximize profits. So there has to be an analysis of the audience. That's what they're really looking at. Who's watching, and how can we sell those eyeballs to specialized advertisers, correct?
That's correct. You know, all of that's a mass media view of the relationship between content and advertising and revenue. And I think that's one that is gradually disappearing, and new models of how to make money from content are coming in because of the internet. So more and more you're going to get journalists especially trying to make less money by selling advertising against their content and more money by having their actual audience pay for the product. It's already happened in the newspaper business, where the New York Times has made a great effort to switch away from relying on advertisers to relying on revenue from its readers. And the television industry or television and radio have yet to work out how to do those models.
Let me tell you about a debate that I experienced when I was working at ABC.
Yeah.
You know, here I was as a media critic and analyst, you know, believing, you know, that TV news is helping to shape Americans' understanding of the world, if it's ideological, if it's pro-war, if it's indifferent to the suffering of people, that will communicate itself and affect our politics, okay?
Yes.
And then I ran into executives who told me, you know, Danny, we don't think we have any impact at all, okay? We have no we don't believe that what we're putting on has any necessary impact in shaping the way our viewers see the world. Okay? You're being too conspiratorial. You're being too analytical. That's not how people think. It's not how what people do. And so they would take this view, no impact. And then when you spoke to people in the advertising department at the networks who are there selling the products to advertisers, they're telling these advertisers, listen, you're going to reach this audience. This audience is a wealthy sliver of the population. You want these people who have advertised with us in the past, have sold more cars, et cetera, and so forth. So there seems to be a war within the networks themselves about how they understand what they're doing.
Yes, that's, you know, it sounds as though they're talking out of both sides of their mouth at the same time. But on the other hand, this is the way in which, what you point out correctly is a contradictory logic, the way in which they square that circle and they make it seem not contradictory. Right. What they mean by, we're not changing anybody's minds with our editorial
content.
Hold
on a second, an Andrew Tyndall translation. Go ahead, sir.
According to Andrew Tyndall, what they mean by, we're not changing anybody's minds by our decision on covering the news is, we cover the news in the way that is non-controversial ideologically. In other words, we aim for the middle of the road. Not so it isn't that we're not changing anybody's minds. It's that we try and make it so that nobody notices that we have a point of view, a political position we're coming from, a worldview that we're embodying. And the reason why we hope that nobody notices is because we try to be as mainstream as possible. In other words, not to be campaigning, not to be radical, not to be controversial, but to spot where the general consensus view is on the political and world affairs, and to try and be as close to as possible to that imaginary center.
Now, I worked in a news magazine, but it was run by, you know, kind of newsmen. You know, it was run by people who had been in the business for a long time. And they clearly had agendas. They clearly had ideas about what issues they cared about and how to present those issues. And one of the things, you know, that I found, for example, at 2020, we were competing at the time with Hill Street Blues on NBC, which was in the same time period. So 2020 counter-programmed Hill Street Blues by running every week a profile of a country music star. They were reaching for another demographic, another group of listeners, rather viewers, and they were successful in doing it. So they were able to keep their advertisers, but they changed their advertisers in a sense because now they were programming to people in the South and the like. Does that experience resonate with anything you've examined?
Right. So, for example, on the nightly news the newscast that I watch. What's happened over the time is that the audiences tend to get older. As you were saying earlier, there are millions of young folk nowadays who are out of the habit of getting their news from a television newscast. So, you know, as the population has shifted and the people who are sitting down and watching the nightly news tend to be older and older, what are older people really interested in? They're interested in their health. And here's an example of the type of content of the news has changed to reflect the audience that they're addressing. You get more stories about illness and health and health care now than you did 15 or 20 years ago.
So, you know, as in 2020, we started doing stories on recreational vehicles, okay? You know, it was clearly had a demographic in mind, and they began using techniques that were used by advertising agencies, focus groups. Would you watch a story about X, Y, and Z run by people in the focus group business to guide them so that their investment in these stories would be rewarded? I remember once, you know, it was about, like, Geraldo Rivera. It, once wants to go swimming with the sharks off the coast of Australia. Would you watch a program like that? It's very dangerous. It's very, you know, we don't know if he'll come back alive, you know, et cetera and so forth. And so, you know, the audience, the people in the focus group said, sounds interesting. Yeah, it sounds like an interesting story. So they commissioned it at a tremendous cost. Two boats are going around the world. He had a great vacation, and he came back, but the ratings tanked for the story, okay? So the focus groups told them, that at least they wanted to hear what that the focus groups would approve of what they were doing, when in fact the reality was the people didn't watch the segment, even though it got a tremendous amount of hype.
And the lesson you drew from that was what, Danny?
The lesson is that you substitute journalistic judgment
for
personality adventure-type stories, which appeal to you, perhaps as a producer, but, you know, an audience that's looking for news and information and is interested in the world is not going to watch that.
I have a really good little test that I use when I watch a story that's on the nightly news to see if it's being reported with us in mind, us the viewers, with our interest first, which is what it should be, or whether it's being reported with the reporter's interest in mind first. In other words, to make them the center of attention. And just do it yourself. You can watch any newscast, and at the end of the story, you can say, now, was the reporter doing something there that made him or her the center of attention, was actually engaging in the activity, or was he or she there in order to observe the activity and tell us about it? And what I say is, those reporters who do that, they are journalists who have confused journalism with being a star in their own reality TV show.
So in other words, what they call, you know, correspondent presence is something which they believe brings in an audience, but actually sometimes it overwhelms the story itself. It's more about them than it is about the issues they're covering. Now, you got into a little bit of a conflict with ABC News, my old network, okay?
Yes, I did.
When you characterized their nightly newscast as having become Disneyfied, a reference to the Disney company which bought ABC and which was... And you took issue with an idea, that they had actually softened their newscast, okay? And the vice president... of ABC News, a guy named Jeff Snyder, with whom I've tangled, I must say, told you, our mission is to give our viewers information that is relevant to their everyday lives. And winning an award for best newscast in 2013 and enjoying our best season in 5 years is far more meaningful than your method that confuses quantity with quality. Okay, this was a put down of Andrew Tindall. How did you respond to this?
Well, he said, I used his own words against him. He said in that quote, we've had our best year. And when you actually inquired, well, what do you mean by your best year? Do you mean you've done the best journalism that you've done for years? He said, no, we've got the biggest audience. So who's the one that was confusing quantity with quality? It was him himself. I was just measuring the amount of resources and the time they gave on various stories and pointing out that they were wildly divergent from their two rivals in terms of how much time they spent on serious stories versus how much time they spent on celebrity stories. And he said I was dealing with quantity, not with quality. And then he turns around and says, and the reason I can prove you're wrong is because we're better. And what he meant is we're bigger.
Well, you know, you on your website, TyndallReport.com, I don't know if you regularly update it, but you have this exchange. And one of the things you note here is that the new mission of TV News addresses its viewers as consumers with tips on handling everyday life rather than as citizens on decisions made politically. It turns away from global concerns to domestic ones, in particular the weather. It's preoccupied with what people are talking about, buzz, rather than what's happening in public policy debates. Its emphasis is on what entertains people over what affects them. This is a good kind of a very tough critique that you've made of the network news. What kind of response did you get, not just from ABC? Do you find that the audience is increasingly aware of this?
Off the record with people who used to, like you, people who used to work for ABC and have got disaffected with the way it's been going under Disney ownership, I got a lot of anonymous and behind-the-scenes support, and they said, do not be deterred from your analysis. It's absolutely correct. It's a standout difference between Diane Sawyer's newscast and the newscast that's on, especially the one that's on CBS, that they're not interested in reporting on the important issues of the day. They're interested in reporting on what they think we already are talking about.
Andrew Tindall, Media Monitor, please stay with us, would you? Because there are a bunch of other issues I want to ask you about Jon Stewart and about, you know, the way in which attitude seems to have replaced information on the air, as well as new news organizations like Vice, which seems to be on the verge of getting a big deal with Time Warner and CNN. So can you stick with us for a little more of this discussion?
Absolutely. A pleasure to do that.
Okay.
Danny.
Thank you so much. We're going to be, I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here with Andrew Tindall. We'll be back in a minute.
We're going to fix that technical problem.
Tick-tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC.
NBC.
CBS.
CNN.
Fox News. Breaking news.
Faking news. The media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
Worked at ABC News, work at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
Danny Schechter, your news dissector, back with Andrew Tindall of the Tindall Report on Media Channel Radio. Andrew, one of the things that has changed, it seems as if a lot of people watch programs that make fun of news, whether it's Saturday Night Live, the late night, programs, certainly Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, now John Oliver's program, that basically tear the news apart. And are they really, what are they learning from these programs? Do you welcome this, or is it just a way of getting comedians to feel superior to journalists?
Well, Danny, I'd like to say that the activity of tearing the news apart was actually one of the founding members of that activity, was the dissector himself.
True.
So I think the distinction you're making isn't with the news is suddenly being dissected, but it's being dissected by comedians now. Is that right?
Right. It is. You know, I mean, and I laugh along with everybody else, but at the same time, it seems what gets conveyed a lot is sort of the put down. It's sort of making fun of people, but not necessarily informing them about the issues in any way. Now, you can argue, well, they're not journalists, that's not their job, et cetera, and so forth. I think John Oliver does a better job of putting things in context in a way. But, you know, a lot of these comedians are very predictable in their approach, and they look for funny, you know, clips from, you know, news programs. Are they really making or helping viewers become more savvy and sophisticated? In some cases, they are.
I agree with you that John Oliver, well, he's only just started his show, but I would agree with you. He looks as though he's going in a different direction, in that he seems to be going towards doing political satire rather than satirizing the news media. And I think the point, the distinction that we have to make is, if you look at, you know, something as very unchallenging as something like the Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live, or something that's maybe a little bit more challenging, which is the Comedy Central people, they're first and foremost, what their target is the news media rather than the underlying political events about which the news media are covering. And that's where I think the confusion lies.
Well, John Oliver, for example, did a story about net neutrality.
Yes.
And no, not only did he present the issues, but he called on the audience to write to the FCC. In other words, very few programs try to involve the audience in any sort of action or activity.
I agree with you. I think John Oliver is going in. I think it's, before long, we won't be putting John Oliver in the same category as the Stewarts and the Colberts. I think he's engaging in a different form of commentary than they are.
Is that because he comes from a different country than they do?
I don't know the man, so I don't know what motivates him. It might be because HBO is a different type of network than Comedy Central.
Now, HBO has also introduced a series, a company called Vice.
Yes.
Who are, you know,
and I think
straight
Bill
out
Maher
of Brooklyn.
With them, isn't he?
What?
Isn't Bill Maher connected with them?
And Bill Maher is connected with them. And
they
say they practice what they call immersionist news. They send reporters to get involved in stories and become, take you to the places that are supposedly the most dangerous and show that they, you know, that they have the guts and the gumption, to challenge, you know, the head of North Korea or
right, they went
the Taliban.
With, they went with Dennis Rodman to North Korea, didn't
right, they?
They
did.
And they got into trouble. Didn't their man get arrested in Ukraine?
It did, yes.
Yeah.
But I mean, I have mixed feelings about what they're doing because I think also it's kind of a new form of tabloid television. You know, it's sort of sensationalistic. It doesn't really offer much context or background to any of these conflicts. And it's like the people with tattoos taking on the people who don't have them, you know, who are not as hip. You know, it's a sort of a...
Right. So you could say what we were talking about earlier. You could say that type of reporting is an example of correspondent's presence, right?
Totally. Totally. Yeah. And, you know... Which is not to say some of what they do isn't very clever, but it's not clear to me that it's the new direction for news. And CNN, they're going to probably have their own channel. They're probably going to take over the headline news channel on CNN, which hasn't been doing well.
Yes.
And we'll have all the Vice all the time.
Well, I think what this is journalism sliding over into reality television, you know? I mean, the reality television takes advantage of all the news gathering technology that journalism uses. The fact that cameras are lighter than they ever were, and you don't need lights, and you've got better microphones and things like that, which are all innovations that are used by journalists, but they're also used by people who are making basically entertainment shows, not journalism shows.
So Vice will probably be doing a lot better. There's another network also. They came out of Canada. Another network coming out of Canada is the Real News Network, or TRNN. And, you know, doesn't have the same marketing muscle and support for their more overtly political and progressive stance. But there are programs like Democracy Now! That have built an audience, it seems like, even without being on a network.
And as I said, the technology is getting more mobile and cheaper and lighter, and more people who are not journalists, not professional journalists, can do journalism just by turning up and observing what's going on. You know, I mean, you're getting people eyewitness accounts of things being using techniques like Twitter, which isn't even television.
So the news world is changing, is transforming. But, you know, the costs of it, not necessarily a deeper democracy, it seems to me. I mean, media is still, the big media anyway, is still really controlled by a relative handful of corporations and companies with more mergers on the horizon, which to me doesn't really indicate there's going to be more diversity of perspective.
Well, it indicates that the organizations that are going to provide more perspectives are not going to be top-down organizations. They're going to have to be bottom-up organizations.
So, you know, here we are in an environment where when you look relatively, you know, I mean, I don't know how true this is, but, you know, the statistics I've seen, you know, about Americans being informed as opposed to people in other countries, Americans are among the least informed. people in the world when they're asked questions specifically about all sorts of issues. They just don't have the answers, in part because maybe because they're watching programs that is more there to program their attitudes than to teach them about the world.
Then there's the other way around of looking at it, which is it's incredible how much information Americans can get about something if they're interested in it. And sometimes even the most trivial things. I mean, people are complete experts at the most stupid, trivial matters, and they can immerse themselves in it and find themselves expertly informed about something, things that don't matter. You know, I mean, people know the ins and outs of celebrities' lifestyles with a degree of sophistication and knowledge that we couldn't even dream of 20 years ago. So it's not that the ability to find out about things is absent. It is that the organization of priorities is absent, and important things are not being separated from trivial ones.
What is your sense of the new generation of journalists? There's certainly quite a few of them, many struggling to find jobs in this system, having great difficulty doing so, you know, carrying tremendous student debt around with them to try to find places to operate and to do stories. And it seems like the people who are enterprising are able to get out there and travel around the world using video cameras and the like in a way that's pretty impressive.
Yeah. I wake up one morning and I'm pessimistic, and I wake up the next morning and I'm optimistic. Things are changing in both directions simultaneously. The ability of somebody on their own initiatives just to go out and make a documentary or to write a long form article or to produce a radio piece is greater now. People do it on their own initiative is greater now than it ever was. Yeah. But as you said, the institutional backing and the funding and the support and the research and all of those things which come from traditional large journalistic organizations, that's less than it's ever been. So things are more than they've ever been and less than they've ever been.
You know, with us in the studio listening in on this conversation is a young woman, a journalist, 23 years old, from South Africa, who came up to work with Global Vision on a project, Kim Harrisburg. And she is filled with ideas about investigative stories she wants to do. She's going to conferences. Her personally went out into Rwanda to begin doing stories about people. How do you react to this conversation, Kim?
For me, it's interesting because I think, you know, when I was studying journalism, we had people coming in saying journalism is dead. You know, you're studying the wrong thing. Coming into our classrooms, we had other people coming in and saying the face of journalism will never be the same. And I think that's true because even for young journalists, we're trying to keep up with the new trends and new types of reporting, and it's changing all the time. And the reality is that anyone can be a journalist. It's not necessarily something you had to study. I think when I think of, evening news bulletins, to be completely honest, I think of my grandparents watching the news, and I think a lot of my friends haven't turned on the evening news in a long time because they're using their cell phones, they're using Twitter, they're using Facebook. And that is the nature of journalism now, which is a scary thing, but it's also a really exciting thing.
Response, Dr. Tyndall.
Hello, Kim. Nice to talk to you.
Nice
I think you're absolutely right that that there's a whole generation that doesn't understand the idea of what a newscast is or what it would be made, why it would be made. And I think they're missing something. And I think people who think that the only way you can watch your news is by a professionally produced newscast, they're also missing something too. So what's exciting about the moment is that everything's in flux, and it's much better, easier now to tailor the content of journalism, the type of journalism, to the needs of the moment than it ever was. But on the other hand, to say, just because I can get a lot of my news through new media or through my social media or and not from journalistic organizations, there's also a lot of news that you really only can get from a journalistic organization, someone who's got the resources and got the editing facilities and got the institutional memory and the expertise to actually go out and remember what happened, you know, more than 6 months ago in order to put events on the ground in the context.
I mean, I was flabbergasted myself, a member of my family. Okay, I'm doing a project about Edward Snowden and surveillance, and he didn't have a clue about any of this. He hasn't been paying attention to it. It doesn't seem to impact on him. I had to explain all of this to him in detail because he just was kind of outside the world of news and media. You know, newspapers are expensive today. You know, people who are not living on their devices, for example, the latest bulletins on everything, are often pushed out of, you know, the kind of the world of you know, civic society that we would like to see them pushed into.
Right, and so I think that the old school civic society oriented mass media organizations that used to exist, they've got to make an extra special effort. In the old days, their content was distributed by the organizations which they controlled. In the modern day, content is going to be more and more distributed by the audience itself. In other words, instead of having a broadcast network, you have a social network. And they've got to make content that if one member of a social network gets it, it's compelling and interesting, and that audience member is going to share it around their social network. And so, you know, your nephew's friends, your cousin's friends were doing him a disservice by not sharing over their social network the news that one of them had found.
But he did know that Bradley Manning had become Chelsea Manning. Okay. He did know kind of the wilder parts of the story, but he didn't necessarily know what Bradley Manning, what documents he had leaked, and how he managed to do it or anything like that. He wasn't aware of the details of the story, but he had the general, he had heard of it, but not much.
So what I tell the people who work at the old school broadcast networks is you have to be spending all of your time concentrating on making stories that are intelligible and easy to share. In other words, not just to view at the other end of a television set, but actually to get into the social networks, and so those stories can be shared around, and they've got to be useful in that context.
Is there a danger of it all being dumbed down if you're trying to reach, you know, people who are not aware of or presumably not interested in X, Y, and Z?
No, I don't think so, because if I decide to share something with you in my social network, and I share with you something that's really dumb, you're going to look at me and say, "What did you send me that for?" You know, it's in prestige for me sharing something that I'm sharing something that's interesting.
So
and informative.
So, you know, in a sense, and this is one of the dangers I think that maybe old folks like I notice or don't comment on, you know, is that it seems like everybody is connected to their devices. It's one-on-one media. They're not interacting with media necessarily or interacting with other people about media. It's hard to even get a conversation going with somebody if they're just, you know, zoned into their, you know, telephone, their smartphone or other media devices, their tablets.
You know, I disagree with you. I think there's a lot of interactivity and questioning that goes on. You see it all the time on Twitter. Somebody says something, somebody links to something, somebody shares something, and then you just get, you know, the comments and reactions from that.
That is true. There is this interactivity that we never had before. I mean, remember there used to be books, you know, how can you talk back to your television set? You know, people felt that they were frozen out of engagement in the media. Now, they're all over the media. In some cases, you know, websites have shut down their comments because there's so much abusive commentary that's just, you know, kind of prevailing in many outlets of people who are, you know, very angry or you know, want to show off their superiority to others.
That's actually what I tell my mom all the time, Danny. If she says, you know, teenagers are being incredibly antisocial on their cell phones all the time, and I tell her they're actually being really sociable, just with other people. And, you know, they can connect with anyone across the world. And like you say, the comment section, tweeting, Facebook, whatever, people are being incredibly social. It's just, it's taking a different medium now. It's not one-on-one. It's, you know, it's across the globe.
So where is all this going? I mean,
right.
the role of the NSA, for example, here we had CBS News. 60 Minutes did a whole story that was the NSA gave them access. It was a bunch of softball questions. The guy who covered it ended up becoming an intelligence official for the New York City Police Department, John Miller, after the program. It seemed like until the NBC interview with Snowden, this whole issue wasn't really a big one on the network. So am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong at all. That's an accurate description of the way it went. I think NBC was, they thought they got a big story when they got the Snowden interview, but I don't think even they knew how much it was going to get talked about. I think even they were surprised.
You know, and yet this NSA story is part of the national defense issues. And on national defense issues, it seems as if the networks have, however independent or feisty they may be, you know, on other issues, when it comes to supporting America's wars or getting, you know, kind of saluting, they seem to jump right into doing so. Are they controlled?
Are they controlled by the Pentagon?
Yeah, I mean...
No, they're not controlled by the... I see no evidence that they're controlled. I think they're timid, but I don't think they're controlled. They think that they're being safe and middle of the road by being patriotic. They're not, in their heart of hearts, they don't think of themselves as global news gathering organizations. They think of themselves as American news gathering organizations. And as such, they identify not only with the government, they identify not only with the nation, but to the government, or at least to the foreign policy of the government.
So there's still a sort of us versus them. What about news networks like Al Jazeera? What kind of job do you think they're doing? Al Jazeera now has an American kind of operation.
I don't study Al Jazeera in the way that I study the nightly newscasts, so it's anecdotal information I've got rather than analytical. I can only talk about my impressions, but as CNN is vacating the space of being a news gathering organization and is going towards reality television, there is the room for Al Jazeera to enter it, and it's, as you say, it's got a more like a global perspective rather than a national one. And when Al Jazeera was founded, it was founded by a lot of people who had been trained by the BBC, and I think you still see BBC pedigree in the worldview and the journalistic point of view of Al Jazeera.
Yeah, they certainly take seriously a responsibility to present, you know, the view and the other view. I mean, they make an effort at balance and to offer perspective. They also cover a lot of the world that American networks are no longer covering. The bureaus are shut down in most places.
That's undeniable. I agree with you completely.
Is that good for our democracy? I mean, in a global era when America, you know, claims to have all this kind of aspiration to be a leader worldwide, and Americans, you know, something's happening in Ukraine. Where is that? What is it? You know, we don't know. How many reports had there been on Ukraine before this recent crisis? So, you know, you have, you know, a situation where people are kept in the dark, really, about things.
Well, kept in the dark is not the verb that I would use. I think people find themselves in the dark.
All right, but let's take Iraq right now. This resurgence of Islamic activism and whatnot comes about because of the type of government that we had put in place there, which rejected all Sunnis, you know, and was acting as a, you know, a dictatorial government run by a guy who was a CIA guy, basically, put in by the Americans.
Okay, so here's the odd thing that's happening in this day and age. You and I and anybody if we were interested, we can find out more about what's going on in Iraq than we could have done in any previous decade of the electronic news media. We've got more at our fingertips if we want to find it out, and we are being given less than ever, right? So it's two contradictory things happening simultaneously. One, there's more available for us to access. Two, there's less being given to us without us asking for it. Now, that to me is the major problem of journalism in the internet age. It isn't a problem of availability, there's plenty of it. It's a problem of priority, how to establish what's important and what's trivial. And that's the thing that the internet age has absolutely been unable to address so far.
And also the whole idea of, you know, the public interest has been interpreted as what the public is interested in.
That's correct.
So people who are in a position to make judgments about what's important for people to know often avoid that because they're more interested in what do people want to hear.
But on the other hand, I think you would, if you wanted to change that thing, in other words, change people getting what they're interested in, you'd have to repeal the internet.
Well, the NSA is doing a good job of that, in a way. But, yeah, I mean, I hear you. We certainly have more information available if we choose to seek it out. We have programs like this, which are trying on MediaChannel.org to offer perspectives about the media that are often not covered in the media.
Right.
In other words, the media itself may be covered as a business in many outlets, but it's not covered as a cultural force and a political force in our culture, and that's why we...
Okay, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. The question is, the answer to the question is a cultural and a political question rather than a media one. In other words, It's at the level of political activism that you're going to get people mobilized to access the type of information that you feel people are being deprived of.
Well, on that point, after a program with some disagreements between us, we can agree on that. Thank you very much, Andrew Tindall of the Tindall Report, and you know, a person who's been around for a long time working on all of this, and his stuff doesn't, you know, it gets better, you know, as he goes along. I have a great deal of respect for your work, Andrew, and I wanted to share your views with MediaChannel.org, and thank you again for being part of it.
Same goes for me, Danny. Double. I've got a lot of respect for you, and Kim, good luck on your do all the good journalism you possibly can.
Thanks, Andrew. Nice to meet you via the radio.
I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. You can communicate back with me at dissector@mediachannel.org. This program will be in our archives as well. We welcome your opinions and your attitudes. Please give us some feedback. And tune in again next week, same time, same station.
To chase and to walk home.